Welcome to Book by Book, a podcast from independent children's publisher Sampasavant and Purick. I'm your host, Leanne, the publishing coordinator for S&P. On this podcast, we feature bite-sized interviews with people from the world of children's books. On this episode, I'm talking to Misty Alvaro from Columbus Metropolitan Library about how the history of cataloging in libraries impacts what stories get told and what the future of cataloging looks like. This is the second part of my conversation with Misty. In the previous episode, we chat about what it means to catalog books in the public library and why bookmakers should care about it. Misty did a lot of things before finding librarianship. They worked at an excavating company, they were a tutor and interpreter for Japanese nationals living in the US, assistant manager of a goth bar, pastry chef, bead store clerk, pizza delivery driver, and a craft class teacher. They've worked in public, academic, and special libraries in public services, technical services, and training for the past 15 years. Misty is currently the materials manager for Columbus Metropolitan Library, overseeing the cataloging and processing of library materials for the whole system. Columbus Metropolitan Library, or CML, is celebrating their 150th birthday this year with lots of exciting events. They first opened March 4th, 1873 as a single reading room in City Hall. Today, they have 23 locations in Central Ohio from Dublin to Canal Winchester.
You talk a little bit now. We're gonna shift gears and talk more. I saw you at a presentation a couple years ago, pre-pandemic. Give a presentation around genre labels.
Right, the genrefication.
Yes, yeah. Genre labels, and by that I mean a lot of libraries, less so now, but you know, you walk into a library and you want to scan the shelf quickly to see, okay, I'm looking for a mystery.
Right.
And you might see on the spine of your library book a little Sherlock Holmes hat with a magnifying glass, and it's a sticker that someone may have put on this book, a librarian may have put on this book. Mm-hmm. You also may have seen, if you've been to your library, little stickers on the spine that have the continent of Africa.
Oh, ouch, yeah.
So these are stickers, you know, and that's supposed to say, I don't know what, honestly.
Yeah, right. It doesn't have a clear meaning.
And what you'll find is that, you know, the example I often go to when we're talking about the African sticker, you know, that's usually the label will say like African American literature.
Right.
But you'll find that it's not going to be applied to a book by, for example, Colson Whitehead.
Right.
Like when Underground Railroad came out and that book was nominated for and won a Pulitzer. The Pulitzer and the National Book Award in the same year, you find that that book did not have the African-American sticker on it. And so can you talk about this discourse in library land, which it is not a monolith.
It is
there
not.
There are many different opinions.
Yeah.
Can you talk about those genrefications and
how that happens
and why, like, why that can be problematic?
Sure, sure. And I think the first thing to address there, you know, when we talk about the Colson Whiteheads of the world, these people who are writing complex, beautiful works that are changing culture, right, that are really making a difference in the lives of human beings. Once they win awards, like, we're really excited that they won an award and we want to tell somebody they won an award. The spine of a book is only so big, right? Like, we can't put every genre and a finding aid to help, like, the shelvers know where this book goes. And, you know, maybe it's a multi-genre kind of thing. It's a genre bender. Mm-hmm. And then there's the awards. So libraries have to make choices about how many labels to put there for one, right? So they're prioritizing in-house which things they think are more important to describe. So that's part of it. I also think that there's an interesting thing when you have what is very much a middle-class white woman-dominated profession. There's this concept of one person being a landslide. And this is something I say to my managers a lot, too, is no one person should ever be a landslide. If someone comes to you and has a beef with something, we don't change our policies because of that. And that is something that's happened a lot in libraries. In my observation, I can't speak for the broader world, of course, but in my experiences, I've seen this happen where someone will say, hey, why don't you have these books identified as having an Asian character? And I'm like, well, because the book isn't about Asianness. Right. Mm-hmm. We're going to call out every book that has a hijabi woman in it. Right. Are we going to put Arab American on all of those?
Yeah.
That's horrible. I mean, that's not the point of labels. The idea of labels is to help people find things. Mm-hmm. Right. why are we helping them find things? And what do we want them to find? And are we asking them what mm-hmm. they want to find? Because routinely, in the past, we were not. We mm-hmm. were deciding. We were gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. We were saying, we feel like you should be reading this mm-hmm. if you're interested in this topic.
I see.
And that's how genre labels were really assigned. I think as the book industry has shared more genre information, like and like with your publisher, you have mm-hmm. a mission to mm-hmm. do a thing, right? Mm-hmm. And so we know that we should be trying to promote a certain aspect of these works. If librarians listen, like if catalogers have that information, they can do it. But so much of it gets slapdash. You know, libraries are, and I think it's really important to mention that libraries are constantly in an existential crisis, right? Funding is cut constantly. I mean, there are always new bills coming up at the state and federal level to cut funding to what is frankly a fundamental institution of human culture, mm-hmm. right? We are preserving and disseminating information. Mm-hmm. What is more important than that in the long term, right?
Yeah. A lot of the sort of stickers and the finding aids mm-hmm. were really, they came out of, you know, this
efficiency.
Classic efficiency, this mm-hmm. classic place of, oh, we want to help the person who comes in and mm-hmm. maybe they don't want to talk to somebody.
Or maybe so, we don't have enough people that totally. They can talk to everyone.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. But then what ends up happening in practical application is that books get left out.
Or over-applied.
Over-applied. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where this project that you're working on, or frankly, it seems like to me, creating data, mm-hmm. the data, the cataloging for that item, mm-hmm. if you make that stronger, mm-hmm. does that then make it easier for someone to find it without sure. putting it into those labels?
Yeah.
So can you talk about the Diverse Voices Project?
Absolutely. So when we identified that we didn't have a good way to find books by authors of specific identities, mm-hmm. we kind of dug deep. Like we went into MARC and found a field that, I mean, to be fair, other libraries are using, not many yet. So it's still kind of exciting to a lot of public libraries in particular that describes self-identity terms, like what the creator has called themselves, mm-hmm. right? So to a point, we trust publishers to tell us that in publisher bios, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
We assume to a point that the author's cool with what you said about them. We don't want to separate books based on the author, because if you take all of the books written by Asian, Hispanic, African-American, Black diasporan authors, right, and you put them in their own sections,
right.
you have a white default.
Totally.
You have this white fiction section.
Absolutely,
right?
You do. And then what happens if your author is Korean and Jewish?
Right. Exactly. Then you have to make that choice for them.
Yeah.
So what we're doing is we're adding, frankly, intersectional terminology too. So we can add a term that says this author identifies as Korean and a term that says this author also identifies as Jewish. That way you can search for either one and get that author.
And then physically in the library,
they're shelved with whatever the subject content is.
Beautiful. Right? So that, you know, if I'm just little old me mm-hmm. and I'm not trying to feel my feels about identity politics today.
Right.
I can go find a book, and then later on I find out, oh, look at that.
I read this, a book by a Korean Jewish author.
Would you look at that?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
great.
Yeah.
What are we doing with Patricia Highsmith?
In terms of what exactly? So do you mean with the...
So, okay, what if somebody's dead? Right?
Which lots of them are.
Lots of them are.
Lots of them are.
So Patricia Highsmith or author similar.
Right.
We don't know how... So queer terminology is a great place to start. LGBTQ
sure, sure, sure.
plus. Mm-hmm. That terminology has changed so much.
And is constantly evolving.
Constantly evolving. Right. It's changing so much even within our lifetimes. Certainly. What do we do with an author? What do we do?
So I think the most important point to make in that is that, again, as you said, libraries are not a monolith. So it depends on who your users are. You mm-hmm. have to know your users, which is another great reason for catalogers to get out of the proverbial basement, mm-hmm. right? And either talk to public services staff or talk to customers directly, right? We need to know what they're looking for and why. If we are in an academic institution that has a large research population looking into the queer experience in one way or another, we know that they want that connection. They want that LGBTQIA reading mm-hmm. of the book, and we will shelve it there so that mm-hmm. they can find it. Mm-hmm. They're the people who are looking for it for that reason.
Right.
If we're in a public library, we generally shouldn't be making assumptions about why someone is looking for a book of fiction.
Mm-mm.
The assumption we make is they want to read the book, right? So as long as they can find it, mm-hmm. do we need to do that,
right?
Do we need to add any of that additional terminology? They can learn that, surely, elsewhere if that is information they want. So it depends. You have to know your users. You absolutely have to know your users and know and guess, frankly, not know, but guess where they are going to try to find things.
Interesting. Okay.
So there's a lot of demographic research that goes into being a highly ethical cataloger. There is. I mean, really understanding who your community is, who is checking stuff out, what they're checking out, right?
Yeah.
And sort of looking at those groupings of material and just doing like a high level analysis of what is this community, what does this community need from us? Like, what do we have to do to help them find what they want?
Yeah, that's interesting. And so when you're talking about the diverse voices and this mark, what was the, or the mark?
Oh, the mark, the tag number. It's a 386. I try not to talk mark to people.
Oh, okay.
It's rude. They tell me it's rude. I shouldn't speak mark.
So when you're talking about that mark field where it's all about the creator's identity.
So there have traditionally not been areas of cataloging records where we could talk about the identities of the creators.
Wow. Okay.
This just has not been a thing. We classify materials based on their content or their genre or form. And so that's kind of a new thing that I'm obsessed with and I'm working with a lot at CML.
Okay. We're kind of talking about right now a new frontier.
Yeah, it
as
is.
It would be to kind of catch up with, you know, because we're talking about every book, every author.
Every DVD.
Right. Putting every, that data, attaching that to the creator. I'm trying to, okay. So when you're talking about that mark field and the creator's identity, you know, let's say Chloe Kim, snowboarder, writes a book about snowboarding. Would her mark still be, like, would her identifiers, identity-wise, be put in there? Or because her book isn't about...
That's the whole point, though.
Okay.
Is that the book doesn't have to be about her identity.
Great.
We are looking for authors who have been marginalized,
perfect.
Right? And that is a big trend in the library user community that people are vocalizing to us. We want to read books by people whom we may not have read because the publishing industry and to be honest, I mean, the library vendors that we work with may not have access to as many books if the big publishers aren't doing them, right? So people are looking for these specific things. But we don't want to classify them based on the author identity. We want them to be findable by the author identity, but we don't want to create this artificial grouping based on ethnicity or gender or sexual preference or religion or whatever it is.
I think that was the key right there. It's trying, because all of this is so, without the books right in front of you, without showing the difference between what we're talking about when we talk about searchable versus where they are physically on the shelf.
So different with an online catalog, right?
So yeah. So you said the difference between classifying them and findability. So again, we're talking about, I think, the difference between putting that sticker on the spine and saying, you know, and also, I mean, frankly, because that has turned people off from reading books.
Sure.
I mean, I myself as a reader, I'm a white woman. If I walk up and I see books that have, you know, the Africa continent sticker on them, I'm like, oh, that, like just immediately. I'm
like it's
oh,
not for you.
That's not for me.
Oh, yeah, that's a shame.
You know? And so it's like the, you know, and now maybe I wouldn't have picked up those books anyway because, you know, for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the books that have like the spiritual, the dove on the.
Which is so rude because usually what they mean is Christian. And they don't say Christian.
No,
right?
You know, and so, or. Any of these classifications where my identity does not fall into them.
Let me tell you a really interesting substory that is specifically about that. The author N.K. Jemisin.
Yeah.
And I read a lot of sci-fi and horror. She is one of my favorites. I adore her books. She has been very vocal, publicly vocal, about not wanting to be shelved, not wanting to be classified with African-American book collections. She doesn't want her books separated from other books that are, frankly, the same genre. She wants to be in the sci-fi section, right? But it's not that she's hiding her African-American identity. It's not that she doesn't want people to find her by her African-American identity. So it's just, you know, we're classifying her book where it belongs in sci-fi.
Yeah.
Right? That's where her book lives, is on the shelf with all of the other sci-fi authors of the world. But then we have this ability now. Thank you to the mark terminology and to these lists and to the, and let's be honest, deep research that goes into establishing that it's okay to add this term. That's the real work of it. We're applying that to make her findable in different ways.
And so speaking to N.K. Jemisin, it is such a good example.
Yeah, she
is. If you're a patron, a customer, and you go online, you know, to CML's website, and you want to be like, oh, I'm a reader and I really, you know, I love Afrofuturism.
Yeah.
You can put that in and say, okay, I want sci-fi written by.
You can. Yeah.
So you can go in and
you
say
can do that.
African-American voices, and then there are extra filters,
yes.
and you can turn on for
yes.
genre.
Or you can do it by age. You can do it by books that are new. You can do it by books that have that are in right now at your nearest branch. You know what I mean? There are all
yeah.
of these filters that are built into library catalogs to help you refine those searches down to really distill what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So you can just sort of start with this big label. You're like, I want to read more Asian authors. Like, why have I not read more Asian authors? So you start with that button, right? And then you say, okay, but what I'm really looking for today is a memoir for teenagers that was just published, because I've read all of the other ones, right? Whatever it is that you're looking for, you can
yeah.
distill that down.
Thinking about the complexity and the nuance of this as a response to a system being built specifically to exclude these groups.
All the systems all being built to exclude
yeah,
these groups,
all of,
right?
Yeah, really. I mean, that's why you have to do this work, because it's been so hard, such an uphill battle to get literally just diverse books, diverse being books being
published
at all. Do you feel at all that sometimes, I don't know what the right idiom or metaphor is, so there's this, you know, diverse voices button,
right,
which is so helpful in the ways that we've described for certain things. And then it kind of helps eliminate some of the problematic othering.
Right, exactly.
Of the books on the shelf. Okay. Because we've been talking about this for, you know, 20 minutes, and not once have we been like, there's a sticker for white women.
Exactly, because there isn't.
There isn't. Question is, where do we stop parsing the identities?
Oh, so I think for me, I have, going into these projects, I have a preset understanding that we are never going to be comprehensive in these descriptions. There is no way to do all of it, okay? My catalog team does not have time to add these terms as they are cataloging books, right? They need to keep up with books as they're arriving so my processing team can label them and get them into customers' hands as quickly as possible. So we have all of these efficiencies built into our workflows, and we spend a lot of time on this, constantly improving efficiency. But trying to do that with a DEI lens means that you have to think very creatively about who is doing the work of identifying those people. So I have a whole team of people who are not catalogers who are doing that research. I give them a name, right? They have a list of names and they say, okay, I'm going to look for this author's self-identity terms. How do they describe themselves? And they'll spend some time on it. They'll dig deep. And if they don't find it, we don't add the term, period. So It's a way of thinking creatively about where the work happens.
Okay.
Because these people are contributing to metadata, even though they're not really working in the record itself.
Yeah.
They're not adding the mark field, right? But these people with this expertise and this passion who are working actively with our customers every day are spending some of their time helping us describe things appropriately.
And then those descriptions, because now they're online, will that be able to be used by other libraries, by other, you know, it's out there, it's online.
Yes and no.
Okay.
So we are in a consortium. So Columbus Metropolitan Library is one of, I believe, 17 library systems in the Central Libraries Consortium. That's a lot of libraries. This is a very library-rich state.
It
if you
is.
Live in Ohio, be glad, because we have the best, just one of the best library communities in the world. We support our libraries. We use our libraries at unprecedented rates. So you used the word siloed earlier, and that is a word that we very commonly use for our catalogs, because our catalogs speak MARC, right? That's their language. They don't speak internet.
Yes. Okay.
So it becomes very difficult. So there is to really get our catalogs to have information that is parsable, available, analyzable by other institutions. So there is actually a movement, and if there are any librarians or catalogers listening to this, I know I will hear them roll their eyes from here. There is this linked data concept, right? And the idea behind it, the core idea behind it, is that we want to use more of that controlled terminology. We want to be selecting terms from a list, that we're all selecting terms from that same list, right? So that if you look up a term on Google, you will get a listing of all the libraries near you that have books about that. That's what linked data is really about. It's about making this work easier. It's about connecting our data in a way that it can't be when it is just in MARC. So what we're doing a lot now in libraries, because it's man, the idea of changing the way we catalog fundamentally to that degree, to use a whole new, to take the code out of it even, or to use a new interface, whatever we do that is Herculean. And we don't have the money and we don't have the time, right? Again, existential threat. People are always cutting our funding.
Yeah.
So the idea of linked data is to make everything easier, basically. But to get there, you have to do a million really difficult things. Mm-hmm. So all of our marked data is parsed, is hidden, is in this silo. So now we have other products that are intervening. We call them discovery layers. And it's basically, it's a patch between your catalog and the internet. Okay. And those sometimes subscribe to the idea of linked data, and they can make your works available to Google, right? They can have a linked data philosophy or component to them, or in some cases, actually translate your marked data into something the internet can read.
Wow.
Right. So it's very complicated. It's all very vendor focused, mm-hmm. right? And that's really the magic. That's when we can really start using each other's data. That's when we're all contributing to those same pools of terminology. We're adding our work and our research, and it really reduces duplication of effort, frankly, across the field.
Yeah. You've mentioned the vendors.
So vendors, I think, are a complicated thing because they determine what we can do. To a point, I had to work with my discovery layer vendor to get this diverse voices search available, just to make it, to index it and make it searchable, right? Because it's a new field. They had no idea. They weren't working with it.
So to kind of tie all of this together, mm-hmm. looking into the future or, you know, your pie in the sky.
I'm a big idealist. I love these.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it feels like with the Diverse Voices Project, mm-hmm. with the work that catalogers are doing, what's your ideal landscape for catalogers going forward, especially when you consider, you know, the future of equity mm-hmm. in the book industry?
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow. That's a great question. I'm going to ask you to say it again so I can think about
sure.
it.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm thinking about how big this, you've used the word Herculean. Yeah. I will borrow that.
Yeah.
This whole thing is so Herculean. And so I don't want to use the phrase Band-Aid on a bullet wound.
Oh, because it won't be.
And it's not a Band-Aid. It's so much more than that.
Yeah, it's a revolution.
It is.
Yeah.
It still feels like, again, if these systems, and by, you know, every system mm-hmm. hadn't been built to exclude women, gay people, people of color, sure. all of these things, mm-hmm. all of these groups of people, if they hadn't been to exclude these people. Would this have been necessary? We're fighting against this huge, you know, racist, patriarchal machine. Sure. And so in your ideal world, you know, what does the future look like? Is it diverse voices tags? What does it look like? And that might be an unanswerable question.
Well, but I have kind of an answer for you because I tend to think of the library field and the idea of catalog data as a human being. As a person itself. So a lot of these antiquated ideas, it was a baby. It was fresh out the womb. It just knew I cry when I need something, right? That was it. So there wasn't a lot of deep analysis. There wasn't the capacity for deep analysis. This was, I want this thing to survive, mm-hmm. period, right? If you can get a baby through till it's a toddler, well done you. But then as the child gets older and it starts discovering the world around it and it starts thinking in different ways about the world around it, starts thinking differently about himself, it really changes the way the child lives their life, right? And so libraries are doing that too. At this point, I feel like we've hit undergrad. I think we've hit undergrad as a profession now. And now we're learning, we're taking all these new history classes and we're like, oh God, Columbus was awful. What a horrible genocidal jerk face, right? We're learning all of these things that we really learned in undergrad as individuals in a way, you know, different ways of looking at the world, a little bit more critical, right? Mm-hmm. And thinking in that idealistic way that undergrads do of how we can change the world. Mm-hmm. So I feel like the future of librarianship, as it were, in this area is we grow up, you know, we grow up and we take these really important lessons with us and we use the power and the wisdom of our age and our mm-hmm. experience to make broad change, to really implement it and to change people's lives. I mean, that's what we're doing. You know, there are all of these little things that people do every day that change people's lives in libraries and they don't have to pay for it.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
It's all free. So I think there's an adulthood, there's a generosity, there's a maturity. Mm-hmm. to what we do, and a confidence, probably most importantly, that we know, we have seen this happen for a very long time, and we know that it's not right. And we know that maybe we don't always know what's right either, mm-hmm. right? We have the self-awareness as a field, perhaps, to expand our view of what's possible.
Well, you did have a pie in the sky.
I did. No, I didn't. Yeah, no,
and I think, and to keep, there is one of the things about the profession that is so wonderful. And frankly, because it's, you know, public libraries do not operate for profit, is you can innovate. Yes. You can try new things. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, you know, Silicon Valley tech, they get a lot of credit for, you know, innovation, pushing innovation forward. Yeah, yeah, but also, you know, librarians should not stop trying new things.
When we innovate, because we are public institutions, we often walk a pretty fine line, right? Because we do represent the entire community. Mm-hmm. So there may be people with whom I would never have a comfortable conversation over a beer, but I still care about them as a user, and I still want them to find the information they want in my library. Mm-hmm. We have legislators in our state, right, who make decisions that may or may not affect our services, right? And we have to respect the reasons they're doing that. We have to work within the library world as it is, which is enormous. It is not, you know, people will say, oh, librarianship is not neutral, right? And we have to push for change. And yeah, but we're working in a very complex environment with very complex funding sources and very complex legislation that affects us as public institutions. Yeah. And so it's, that's where the maturity comes in, that maturity and wisdom. Like, how do we know how to make important things happen?
And doing, you know, those innovations with a lot of thought.
Yes.
Not just blazing forward, but really putting so much thought into it. And how are we going to do this and take those lessons we've learned and not make it worse? Yeah. Thank you so much. Yay. This was amazing. Oh, thank you so much for sharing so much of your expertise. I mean, like you said, the catalogers are in the basement. So people just, we don't know what's going on. We don't know when you know, it's adjacent to the internet. It's like,
it is.
We know somebody knows what's going on. So thank you for sharing.
Yay. Thank you so much for interviewing me. This was delightful.
Oh, good. Okay. So before I let you go, finally, the fifth time I think I've said that, what are you reading, watching, listening to, or playing right now that you want to talk about? You don't necessarily.
Grady Hendrix. Oh, man, Grady Hendrix. I'm in love with. Okay. I told you the horror and sci-fi are really my thing. And I read the newest Grady Hendrix book, which was How to Sell a Haunted House. Creeptastic. Oh, my gosh. Like, I actually have a meme saved on my phone about one of the characters that I'm waiting for my spouse to finish reading the book so I can show them without it being a spoiler. It's just like, we're at that point.
I love that.
So I finished How to Sell a Haunted House, and then I started the Southern Book Club's Guide to Killing Vampires, I believe, was the title.
Wait, that's Grady Hendrix?
That's Grady Hendrix.
Wait, I've read that book.
It's wonderful. It was so good.
It was much less about vampires than I thought it was going to be about.
I know, right?
Yeah. And I had never read anything by Grady Hendrix before, but I really liked it.
It was really good. To be fair, I never just read one book at a time.
Oh, okay.
I'm also reading The Ballad of Perilous Graves. Oh. And where's the other one I'm reading? I'm like, I just pulled up Libby to find what I'm reading.
Yes, that's always
right? It's what I did. Oh, yeah. Plain Bad Heroines, which was recommended by one of the processing team members here. And it's weird and delightful.
It is. That's
and I'm terrified, by the way. I was attacked by a ground nest of hornets when I was 7. Okay. I lived, obviously. Survival rate's at 100%. But there are hornets in this book. So if you, like me, have issues with that, go in with eyes wide open because
it's wide open for the
screaming.
Who's that one by?
Plain Bad Heroines is by Emily M. Danforth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. Lots and lots of hornets.
That was a good book. It was long, but it was a good book.
It was good. It's really good. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Misty. Okay.
Thanks,
this was great. I'm so sorry. I took so much of your time.
Again, I'm your host, Leanne, and I'm the publishing coordinator at Sambasavan and Purick, talking with my guest, Misty Alvaro, the materials manager at Columbus Metropolitan Library. Don't forget to check out part one of my conversation with Misty in our previous episode, where we discussed library cataloging and why it should matter to bookmakers. Find Columbus Metropolitan Library across platforms at Columbus Library and columbuslibrary.org. Sambasavan and Purick you can find on Instagram at sambasavan_purick and sambasavan_purick.com. If you have any questions, comments, ideas for future episodes, or just want to say hi, email Leanne, LEANN, @modernmarigoldbooks.com. Thank you so much for listening.